Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
Well, the financial support has been one of supporting farm income, and farm income, according to USDA, will be record large this year. So the last couple of years have been very positive for the farmer. And generally speaking, I'm not looking for next year to be all that adverse, but, you know, everybody has their hand in the pocket of the farmer.
Dan Bossy is president of Ag Resource Company in Chicago.
Those hands are difficult to take out. Prices on almost everything are rising. It's giving the farmer anxiety. So as you look forward to the next farm bill, I believe that carbon will be part of the discussion. But at the end of the day, I'm afraid because of the division in Washington, we still leave farm policy about at the same spot where we are today, which is revenue insurance as a supportive peg for the farmer. But whether or not we can bring in some of these other cropping mechanisms like cover crops and carbon has yet to be seen.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
The production changes this month are pretty modest overall in terms of cotton production. They did make an adjustment on cotton yields, adding 13 pounds an acre to get to 868 pounds an acre. That's a pretty modest change. It's about 1.5% increase over the prior month's estimate.
Dr. Seth Meyer is chief economist at USDA. He's referring to the latest World Ag Supply and Demand Estimates Report, the WASDE for December, where the National Ag Statistics Service is now projecting lower season average farm prices for wheat and corn, steady prices for soybeans and cotton. Again, Meyer, looking at cotton, said USDA projecting higher domestic production with the record high average yields, but still lower mill use and exports will lead to a reduction in expected world demand and trade. Now, the weaker export demand, again, is pressuring the commodity prices as NAS has lowered corn exports based on higher domestic prices and a strong dollar with foreign buyers switching to lower-priced alternatives. Pressure also spreads to sorghum. NAS is projecting a substantial decline in demand from China. That's the top foreign buyer for U.S. sorghum, though domestic users could offset the reductions with increases in food, seed, and industrial feed use. Well, the Senate expected to take up the annual 2023 National Defense Authorization Act. Rarely has anything to do with ag, but a bit of wrangling for members of the House to pass the Water Resources Development Act, the WRDA of 2022, as part of the $858 billion NDAA makes permanent the current cost share for inland waterway projects. Now, the final WRDA will ensure the cost share formula for inland waterway construction projects will only require 35% from the general treasury. 65% will come from the Inland Waterway Trust Fund. And that's what those users of the waterway trust or the inland waterways pay into. Now, what this also does is it removes a provision that would sunset the cost share back to 50-50 in 10 years. Look at it this way. It will save taxpayers money. Now, the bill authorizes more than $37 billion in federal funds for inland waterway projects. It's expected to pass the Senate, be signed into law. Well, we need the ability to move products up and down the rivers. Pork, just a good example of how important infrastructure is. U.S. pork producers enjoying one of the largest export increases in more than a year, as October data recently released by USDA and compiled by the U.S. Meat Export Federation, or USMEF, shows a 5% year-over-year expansion in volume. Now, so far, year-to-date, pork exports by volume still off 12% from the first 10 months of last year. Export values down 8%. Still, USMEF President and CEO Dan Hallstrom notes the results bolstered by outstanding growth in variety meat exports as they set a new record value, $126.2 million, and a record export volume. Actually, the second largest mark on record, more than 55,000 metric tons. It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Well, personal relationships are really important, especially in the Asian cultures.
Former Iowa governor and ambassador to China, Terry Branstad.
One of the advantages I had was I was the first American governor to host Xi Jinping when he was just a county-level party secretary, and he led an ag delegation to Iowa in 1985. And I had been to China in 84, and we'd been treated very well there, so we wanted to go all out to treat him well. And so he calls me and the Iowans he met in 1984 old friends. So building that kind of relationship is really important. And, of course, the Meat Export Federation and many agriculture work groups have worked for decades to build personal relationships. That is critically important, and especially been challenging now as we've gone through this COVID epidemic over the last two or 2.5 years. But we need to hopefully get past that and continue those relationships.
And he explains some of the supply chain disruptions.
Shanghai, I think, is the biggest port in the world. And when you have this kind of a heavy lockdown there, it does disrupt the supply chain and it hurts our trade.
Now, speaking of trade, China's been a hot market for U.S. pork.
We benefited when they went through the African swine fever and they lost a lot of their pork herd. They had to rebuild it. And of course, the Chinese, their top choice of protein is pork. So we were able to export a lot of pork during that time, and now it's a little different situation. They actually are putting a pork into reserve in China because they have an excess amount right now, but I think it's all going to change with the price of corn and soybeans being where it is. I'm sure that pork production in China will probably be reduced, and so I grew up on a farm. I've seen the ups and downs in the market over the years, and we need to be able to deal with both the ups and the downs.
But should we be concerned about China and Brazil?
Brazil is in the southern hemisphere, and they are a major producer as well as us. They will always purchase from both of us, I think. But a lot will depend on the crops and the market and all of that sort of stuff. And so, we need to recognize Brazil is a competitor, but I think they need both of us. The other thing is Ukraine. You see, the Ukraine is a major grain producer, and that's been tremendously disrupted by the war. So they're trying to make up for that by purchasing from Brazil or wherever they can.
So where should the U.S. focus in the future?
Well, we need to be looking all over the world for where the opportunities are. Obviously, China's a big market, but it's not the only market. There's a lot of other growing Asian markets that we need to work at, trying to reduce some of their market-distorting tariffs and things like that, as well as Europe and other parts of the world. So Europe's always been a challenge for us as well. We just need to look out. We need to put America first. We need to make sure that we're doing everything we can to open markets and knock down barriers to our agricultural products anywhere and everywhere in the world.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
We remember our history. Two meaningful pieces of legislation were signed a long time ago when President Lincoln was trying to keep the country together during the Civil War, maybe perhaps our most divided moment in America's history.
Jim Costa is a representative from California. He's also on the House Ag Committee.
And on July 1st, he signed the act that created the Transcontinental Railroad to bind the nation from coast to coast. But the very next day, July 2nd, he signed the Mallory Act that created land-grant universities. And I think that is not traditionally seen as infrastructure, but land-grant universities have been part of America's ability to maintain its cutting edge in technology, and how much that has transformed our ability to be so successful. Throughout our history, farmers have researched ways to optimize their ability to produce livestock and crop production. And over the past few decades, but even further back, going back to the development of our land-grant university system, working with the private sector, we've been able to figure out ways to grow more sustainable food at a faster rate. And therefore, it's, I think, incumbent upon us as policymakers to ensure that we take advantage of the latest cutting-edge technology, because with climate change, we know just last week, the Department of Defense highlighted 13 countries in the world in which water allocation is going to be so critical that their ability to maintain stability in those countries is going to be a question mark. And so, you know, whether it's biotechnology, more drought-resistant plants, or whether it's technologies to use water more efficiently, are all part of what we have to do. The staggering drought that we're having in the West is a reflection of these changes in climate. And in California, we're seeing drought conditions that we've not seen since 76 and 77.
Now, Costa talking about the importance of ag research and technology. Dr. Jim Baird on the importance of biotech.
From my perspective, biotechnology is the future of agriculture and the future of food security for our changing planet. It has the ability to reshape the direction of our industry and our world as we strive to advance the sustainability of agriculture, improve animal health and well-being, and plays a role in all the efforts to feed, clothe, and fuel our ever-changing planet. However, this can only be the case if we are able to take advantage of this technology and allow innovation to happen. At the present time, I don't think our regulatory system is keeping up with the technology of the products that are being developed from this industry. And so our system needs to improve and become more rapid about approving biotechnology products. So I look forward to our conversation this morning between our guests and colleagues, and truly hope that this hearing will be a fruitful exercise guiding future debate, legislation, and regulatory changes. I value this as an opportunity to hear directly from the industry and academia about our current regulatory framework, how this system does or doesn't work, and how we can balance what industry needs to make this technology successful against an important need for consumer trust and confidence. I hope to hear about upcoming changes to these regulatory frameworks and what benefits and challenges they may bring to the industry.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
You know, really, when I looked at the data that came out from the USDA, I didn't see anything that really shook me in terms of a massive deviation relative to expectations.
Bob Maurer, Manduka Trading in Chicago, looking at the December World Ag Supply Demand Estimates from USDA.
I guess maybe surprisingly bullish for soybeans, surprisingly bullish for wheat, and bearish for corn. So I think there was some tweaking here in the U.S. In terms of expectations for the ending stocks here in the U.S. for that marketing year. But most other data that came out, in my opinion, were pretty close. I think the trade did a pretty good job of giving pre-report estimates, at least in terms of the average. For example, in terms of the world grain ending stocks, not just U.S., but the world grain ending stocks, corn came in modestly bullish relative to expectations by about, let's say, 2 million metric tons or so. I don't know if that really moves the needle when you look at the context of the world situation. Soybeans and wheat, in terms of world grain ending stocks, pretty much came extremely close to the numbers, so no big surprises there. And then in terms of the world crop productions, obviously our focus and their focus is going to be down in South America. And yeah, it was tweaked a little bit lower than the average guesstimate going in there, but not by much. So for example, a million metric tons for Brazil, their production, 126 was what the USDA posted as their expectation, as opposed to the average trade guesstimate of 126.7. So just off by 0.7. Soybeans were off by 0.8. So it came out at 152 from the USDA. Average guesstimate was 152.8. So in my opinion, you know, pretty close. In terms of Argentina, actually, I guess maybe if there was going to be a surprise, I think the average guesstimate was a little bit more aggressive on the downside in terms of their production, at least at this point. I mean, maybe USDA ends up coming their way. But in terms of Argentina's corn production, the USDA thinks it's going to be 55 million metric tons. That compares to the guesstimate going in, which is 53.2. And then for soybeans, 49.5 from the USDA versus 48.6. So I know it's a lot of numbers being thrown at everybody. But net-net, on balance, I think for the most part, this whole report, if you look at the whole thing together, basically ended up being about a push in most of the marquee numbers that came out. To your point, though, in terms of cotton, you know, that's for corn, wheat, and soybeans, basically. In terms of cotton, the USDA raised their yield estimate to 868 pounds from 855 in November, so a big increase. Production forecast at 14.24 million bales from 14.03, so bigger yield, bigger production. U.S. exports were lowered by 250,000 bales. The 12.25 domestic usage was lowered by 0.1 to 2.2 million, and the ending stocks increased to 3.5 million bales from 3 million. So a huge, mostly negative compared to prior report data that came out from the USDA regarding cotton. So that's the U.S. story in cotton. In terms of world ending stocks, they increased it to 89.56 million bales from 87.27. So relative to what the trade had been expecting, I guess, and relative to previous expectations from the USDA, it looks like they're expecting, you know, some kind of dearth in terms of demand for cotton. And we'll just have to see how that plays out. And obviously, China's going to be a big input in that equation. And when you hear of some of the bigger picture things like greater lockdowns for COVID and some voluntary lockdowns for COVID in China, that kind of sends a shiver through anybody who's trying to export in the world in terms of pricing for cotton. So I think that's one thing that's definitely playing into that.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
I think it's important to start with the fact that, you know, we all identify the SEC Southeastern Conference because we've never been regulated by the Securities and Exchange Commission before.
Mary Thomas Hart with the National Cattlemen's Beef Association on a proposed rule from the SEC, Securities and Exchange Commission.
The agricultural industry, by and large, is not subject to SEC regulation because the SEC was created to regulate publicly traded entities and to manage and enforce laws against market manipulation. So because most of the agricultural industry isn't publicly traded, we're not subject to those rules. But in recent years, shareholders for these publicly traded companies have been more and more interested in getting information from the supply chains of the companies for which they partly own. And the SEC has attempted to provide that information by proposing some different regulations that aim to get further down the supply chain and get information beyond those publicly traded entities. And this is just the latest example of that, but it's the first time that agricultural producers could really be implicated by a reporting requirement from the SEC. So back in March, the SEC proposed a rule that would require mandatory greenhouse gas emissions reporting from all publicly traded entities. Now, that includes scope one, or direct emissions, scope two, or emissions from gas and electricity generation, and scope three, or supply chain emissions. So now when we talk about scope three emissions, we're talking about any publicly traded company that sells beef being required to submit reports on greenhouse gas emissions to the federal government from the U.S. cattle production supply chain. And that poses a few issues for cattle producers. First, you know, there is no accurate way to collect this information. The EPA has been working to develop emissions estimation methodology for years. And then secondly, you know, I think the fact that we aren't able to accurately disclose that information puts us at potential legal liability from those publicly traded companies or their shareholders.
Not to say it never works, but regulations and ag usually don't go well.
We've dealt with this issue before, right, in terms of CERCLA mandatory reporting or EPCRA mandatory reporting requirements. All of those, you know, are different laws with some kind of different requirements, but at the core, the issue is the same. The federal government is asking for information that isn't available and isn't easy to come up with. And so it puts an additional burden on farmers and ranchers across the country to, one, kind of do the paperwork to figure out their emissions, and then submit those reports to a publicly traded company that will then turn around and submit those reports to the federal government. And if those reports aren't accurate, then we put ourselves at liability, you know, of being sued by companies or by their shareholders. And honestly, I think, you know, when we talk about the fact that farmers and ranchers could be required to submit inaccurate information to these companies, it honestly seems like a disservice to those shareholders, because it seems irresponsible to be mandated by the federal government to provide no information that we know is inaccurate. And if I were a shareholder, I would rather have no information than incorrect information, which is what they're going to end up with.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
A lot of times when I'm dealing with the clients, farmers, when you start talking about bases, I get this deer in the headlights look, like, what are you talking about?
Eric Gullixrud is Vice President of Tax and Accounting with Compeer Financial.
It is a very important concept, especially when it comes to estate planning and that type of thing. So just to give, I'm going to start with that, the basics here of bases. And, you know, it's your original basis of, in property is adjusted, increased or decreased by certain events. Then, for example, if you add some improvements to that, add up, you know, some other items, your basis can go up. Likewise, if you take depreciation, have a casualty loss or some credits, you can actually reduce your basis. So the basis is a very important concept in tax for sure.
He has an example.
Purchase of tractor in 2018, $100,000. I bought it straight out, and you take off the depreciation. So today, my remaining basis in this tractor is $64,286. So just wanted to give you a basic example of what basis is.
So how does this all work?
So when we move into inherited or stepped-up basis, what we're talking about is basically it's inherited will have a basis equal to its fair market value at the date of the decedent's death. And that's what we call the stepped-up basis. Now, that is going to depend on which state you're in, community property state like Wisconsin I'm in. We can get a full stepped-up basis. So mom or dad pass away, we get the full stepped-up basis. Everything is appraised and determine what that new basis is. So, again, it depends on what state you're in. The surviving spouse, you know, will either get a whole or half up there. And so the basis step up basically includes pretty much everything that the owner owns. So we've got real estate, the buildings and improvements, machinery and grain and livestock, and growing crops and inputs. And that's an interesting one for the growing crops. For example, if the farmer, you know, deducted all this seed and fertilizer in December and passes away in February, or even after that, all those expenses or costs, it's an inventory item, could all be taken as a step up and re-expensed. So any assets of any value should be considered supplies, whatever it is that the farmer owns. One of the other differences here is corporations. It is not quite as lucrative because of the assets inside the corporation do not get the step up, but they are all valued, and then that increases your basis in that corporation. So the person inheriting those shares will not see really the value of that step up until the day that they sell the corporation.
And offers a basic scenario.
So I did put together just a basic farm scenario here. So here we got the land, buildings, machinery, crops, and the home fair market value of $10,700,000. The basis at the date of death, and we see a lot of this with real estate if they've owned it 20, 30 years, a lot of buildings depreciated out, machinery depreciated. So in this particular case, the basis at death is $940,000. If this was a case where they, like Wisconsin community property state, everything stepped up, the surviving spouse would now have a basis of $10,700,000, and all those buildings, machinery, can all start to be re-depreciated again. So this is huge. So one of the ideas that was going to throw out and still is throw the stepped-up basis out of the equation. We're back to that surviving spouse having that original basis at death, and we're talking some pretty tremendous tax consequences. And unfortunately, quite a few of our clients, aren't debt-free at death, and so not only have the debt or the debt that is remaining, but they also have, they're going to have the tax consequences to take care of.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Back in September, Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack announced the first round of funding, $2.8 billion, for 70 projects in the Partnerships for Climate Smart Commodities Initiative, projects to help producers earn more by learning more about adopting climate smart practices and measuring the benefits of them. Now, those projects were generally large scale.
But we recognized that we also had to address and attend to the needs of small-sized family operations, as well as those who have been historically underserved.
So Vilsack was in Alabama Monday at Tuskegee University announcing the second pool of funding for smaller-scale climate-smart projects.
We're announcing $325 million to be awarded to 71 additional projects,
adding up then to $3.1 billion for 141 projects.
We think this is going to generate new income sources and new income opportunities for farmers, ranchers, producers, and forested landowners.
Gary Crawford, Washington.